Autumn Shadows in August, a novel by Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Chapter 6. The next morning, our last in Amsterdam, we got up at 8 o'clock, went downstairs for breakfast, and returned to our room to finish our packing. I tried phoning Undine at 9, but there was still no answer. There was a light drizzle outside, but here and there a few breaks in the gray clouds signaled a better day ahead. It was unusually quiet, with no voices rising up from the streets, only the occasional swish of tires on the wet pavement. At 10 o'clock I phoned the Knorr's shop again. A woman named Marion, who spoke some English and was a friend of Undine, answered.
"Oh yes, Mr. Thompson, Undine told me about you. I'm afraid something terrible has happened," she said, her voice suddenly choking up. "Thomas is dead."
"Oh, my God, my dear God!" I didn't know what else to say. Cowdy was watching me, her hand covering her mouth. "What happened? When did he die?" I asked.
"He died on Friday, 3 days ago."
Marion started crying. A moment later she said,
"He died of mind and heart, not of the body. Now Undine must look for the I don't know the English, the place for the body."
"A casket? A grave?"
"Yes, maybe. A box for the body and a place in the ground."
"My God, this is terrible, Marion. Can you tell Undine we phoned and tell her how sorry we are? We're leaving Amsterdam today and we'll go to Basel. We'll be staying at the Alexander Hotel. We should arrive around 5 or 6 o'clock. We'll be there for 3 days. Now probably isn't a good time to see her, but we would like to see her before we leave Basel. Would you tell her that?"
"Yes, I will tell her. Maybe you should call Undine at her home. I think she will like to hear you. It is very difficult for her now, and friends are important."
I hung up the phone after Marion told me Undine's home phone number. I looked at Cowardy, who also had tears in her eyes. We both sat down and stared at the floor. "I can't believe it. I just can't believe it," I said. Cowardy put her hand on my shoulder and asked, "What should we do?"
"Go to Basel as planned, and see Undine when we can. I'm sure she's busy arranging the funeral and everything, but I think it would be good to see her. This is too eerie. I just can't believe it. After all these years, then making contact with Undine before we left Japan and coming all the way to Germany just to see Thomas, and now, 3 days before we see him, he dies." I slumped further into the chair. "I had no idea. Back in Japan, when Undine told me he was not in good condition, I thought she meant financially, not this. I just can't believe it."
"Yes, time has come today," I thought. The journey had, in essence, become one with dark as the grave wherein my friend is laid. I was living a version of Lowry's trip to Mexico in 1946. How could I not have seen it? How could I not have seen that all these omens, premonitions, forewarnings had not been for me and Cowardy, but for Thomas and all that he had symbolized? And what now did his death mean? Was there something significant in this? Was this a sign that I was now being separated from my past? Is that what Pablo had been telling me? I looked into Cowardy's eyes for a long time. They were full of sorrow. I wanted to explain my thoughts to her, but no words came, so I smoked a final Amsterdam joint and lifted it to heaven in tribute to Thomas. "Here's to you, old buddy. You were a hero to me. Like Juan Fernando, you too threw away your mind, you old maker of tragedies. I hope you're where you belong, in a world of peace and contentment." Later, Cowdy and I took a final walk before heading to the airport. It had stopped raining and some patches of blue were appearing. We sat on a bench beside the Singal. Bicyclists in dark, earthy colors sped by on the bicycle path in back of us. Scores of pigeons and seagulls waddled about in front of us. An old wino was sprawled on the bench to our right. A younger man stood behind the bench as if looking over the wino. The attendant looked at me, smiled, and motioned me over. "Pablo?" I blinked my eyes to refocus, but the attendant was gone.
I close my eyes once more, and in my mind I get up and approach the bench to get a better look at the wino. It's the ghost of Malcolm Lowry. I suddenly want to talk to him, ask him about his life and hallucinations and obsessions and paranoias, Juan Fernando, Thomas, the whole nine yards. I tap him on the shoulder and ask, "So, Mr. Lowry, how did you really die?"
"By misadventure," he says, slobbering and rising slowly to get a look at me.
"No, really, I mean, how did you really die?"
"Choked on my own puke."
He gives a derisive snort, and some spit lands on my shoulder. I wipe the spit off with my right hand and sit down next to him. What should I do in Lorac? What does Thomas's death mean? Is he my Juan Fernando? Lowry peers at me, then waves his trembling hands in the air and shrugs.
"Do what you want. That man's death is just death, that's all. And how should I know what he is? Who gives a fuck? It's your problem. You got anything to drink?"
I pull two warm beers out of my pocket, pull the tab off the first one, and hand it to him. He downs half the can in one gulp, burps loudly, and pats his stomach.
"Now, that's much better."
He peers at me again and says,
"Now, what was it you wanted?"
"I wanted to talk about your life, your writing, your experiences, the influence you've had on me, stuff like that."
"That's a tall order."
He drains the rest of the beer, tosses the can over his shoulder, grabs the second one, opens it, and asks,
"Have you ever been so thirsty you'd drink your own piss?"
"No, I can't say that I have."
"Well, you should try it sometime. It'll put hair on your chest and make a man out of you," he says, and breaks into a convulsion of laughter, spittle running down his chin. "How about drugs? Do you have any phenobarbital? It's a benign and helpful drug, you know."
"I'm sorry, Mr. Lowry. All I have is some marijuana."
"Ordinarily, I don't care for the stuff, but if it's all you have, I'll have a go, I suppose."
I produce a joint from my pocket, light it, take a drag, and hand it to him. He looks at it for a moment, takes a hit, and says,
"Doesn't taste like the stuff they had in Mexico. Not bad, though."
He takes another hit and hands it to me. We both stare at the river. Then Lowry takes another drink, clears his throat, and says,
"About my writing, well, I have to confess that I'm going steadily and even beautifully downhill. My memory misses beats at every moment, and in the mornings, as you can see, I'm usually on all fours. I'm only sober Mary in a whiskey bottle."
He pauses for a moment, then says,
"I've now reached a stage where every night I have total recall and write five novels in imagination, but, dreary me, I'm unable to write a word."
For a moment he gazes in the distance, then continues,
"It was the success I had that was the ruin of me. Success is like some horrible disaster. It may be the worst possible thing that could happen to any serious author. Christ, the celebrity visited on me by the New York Literati was embarrassingly awful."
A grin spreads slowly across his face. Suddenly he shouts,
"All is vanity, saith the preacher, all is vanity,"
and glances at me to see what effect he is having. I smile weakly.
"After my success, I wanted to give up writing because half of what I want to say is unbearable and the rest is inexplicable. Do you follow me?"
He lifts the beer can to his mouth. "Yes, I think so."
"Good. Say, do you want to see my varicose veins and leg ulcers?"
"Why not?" He bends down painfully and pulls up his pants legs to expose his pasty, swollen limbs. Blue veins stretch from groin to ankle on both legs.
"It's the same illness that struck the King of England, you know."
"Check these out." I show him first the scar running down half the length of my right arm, then my own swollen ankles. "Not as bad as yours, but almost in the same league. I understand what it is to grit your teeth with each step you take." Lowry takes a close inspection and seems impressed.
"All suffering improves the writer and the work. I can see there must be some merit in your own work."
He looks me straight in the eye and says,
"Life is a fearful and deathly nightmare, a vaudeville show with horrors of every kind, a vagina with teeth that snap tight on any penis that enters."
He breaks into another convulsion of laughter, then coughs up a large ball of phlegm, spits it out, takes another drink of the beer, and with a smug expression says,
I once broke my back falling off of one of my own erections. They trussed me up in a straitjacket at a padded cell in the psychiatric ward in Vancouver General, where they fed me drugs that gave me psychic visions. In Paris, I was admitted to the psychiatric ward of the American Hospital for 10 days. In Haiti, I became a voodoo priest. Jung was so impressed by Under the Volcano that he offered to treat me for nothing. I am Canada's Dostoevsky, and there's not a drop of mezcal that I haven't turned into pure gold, not a drink I haven't made sing.
I hold his gaze and say, I've taken 75 hits of acid and lived to tell it. I've traveled with nomads in Afghanistan. I've been pronounced insane by military prison psychiatrists and sniffed at dead babies in piles of garbage on the streets of Calcutta. I've vomited my words on hundreds of pages in 3 books. I'm America's rotten son and proud of it. Lowry leans back and rocks with laughter. He claps my back and shakes my hand.
Excellent, excellent. You make me laugh. What was your name again? Where did you say you're going?
David Thompson. I'm on my way to Lorach, Germany, to see Thomas's wife. Thomas was an old friend who just died, a friend who was perhaps like your Juan Fernando. After that, my wife and I will head to Italy, to Florence and Rome.
Ah, Italy. I envy you. It's a wonderful place. Rome is the happiest and loveliest city I've ever seen, full of lovers, motor scooters, and monks. Do you know that Gogol wrote part of Dead Souls in Rome? Mann, Ibsen, Mérimée, and Schiller all lived there at one time or another, too. I myself was taken to a Roman sanatorium and gained much inspiration from the experience. Oh yes, Italy, Italy. In Naples, I sought out the old medieval part of the city and found a nice little Dostoevskian scene. A maze of filthy, foul-smelling slums swarming with ragged children, diseased beggars, women nursing babies, and men playing cards. You, of all people, should appreciate that image.
Lowry smiles gently at me. Yes, I do.
On that same journey in, what was it, 48, if I remember correctly? Yes, 1948. Marjorie and I climbed Vesuvius, and what do you think the guide told us at the summit?
I have no idea.
He said, last week she gave it the big shake.
Lowry grins and continues.
And then in Capri we stayed at the Hotel Belvedere et Trere. Isn't that a lovely name? It was on the beach at Maria Grande. There was this Lithuanian artist who ran the place, and he told us his father had been a great friend of Dostoevsky.
Really?
Yes, and do you know what he said about Dostoevsky?
Another mad grin is growing on Lowry's face. What did he say?
Fyodor was an awfully nice fellow,
Lowry says very slowly, then points a finger at his right temple.
But sicker in the head.
We both laugh for a long time. Lowry has another coughing spasm, then polishes off the rest of the beer. I relight the joint and we pass it back and forth in silence. After a while, I notice Cowardy is motioning to me from the other bench. I turn back to Lowry and say, I'm afraid I must be going soon, Mr. Lowry. Thank you very much for sharing some time with me. I've enjoyed visiting with you. Lowry takes my hand and grips it firmly.
Thank you for bringing an old drunk some cheer. You asked me about my writing. I should tell you that I've always written out of despair. I always feel desperate, so then I always try to write, except when I'm too despairing. I write because I'm a humorist. I believe it's necessary for the artist to descend to hell and return to testify in the form of his work. We must forever strive towards the better thing, for the hope of salvation for sinful mankind. Juan Fernando was my better thing. Perhaps your Thomas will be yours. Remember, whosoever unceasingly strives upward, him can we save.
I'll remember.
And one more thing.
Lowry is still gripping my hand, smiling sadly, and looking deeply into my eyes. His look is full of amusement, irony, roguishness, and fellow feeling. Yes?
I have a gift for you.
He reaches into his pocket, pulls out a battered copy of Hesse's Steppenwolf, and hands it to me.
Here, I want you to take this and read it. Pablo told me to give it to you. On your trip so far, you visited both the Black Eagle and the Magic Theater. Those experiences and the contents of this book are closely connected. You should reflect on all of this before moving on to the next stage of your life. Whether you know it or not, you're going through your own midlife crisis, like Harry Haller himself. We'll talk about all of this at a later time and laugh about it. Now be off with you. And whatever you do, wherever you go, make notes, my man. Make notes.
The rush of flapping wings and the sound of Coyote sucking in her breath snapped me out of my reverie. We watched the birds taking off and noticed the clouds were also on the move and more blue was appearing.
They have wonderful skies to watch here, Coyote said, then was silent again.
A few minutes later she sighed heavily and murmured, Amsterdam, as if trying to find the correct word to explain the overall depth of emotion her experiences were giving her.
Amsterdam, I repeated.
We returned to the hotel to pick up our bags. Then we walked to the central station and took a train to the airport. On the way, we passed a beautifully kept Little League baseball diamond with colored billboards for sponsors as the outfield fence. My thoughts took me back momentarily to my early days in Japan when I'd bonded with the people in my neighborhood through the medium of softball. That neighborhood softball team became my Japanese family over the next 4 years. They, in effect, raised me from my first baby utterances of Japanese until the time I could stand on my own 2 feet. They accepted me as one of their own, allowed me to participate in all their family dramas, rituals, and celebrations. Through them, I made my deepest connection with Japan and came to feel as if, finally, after 15 years of wandering and searching, I'd found a place to call home. A place where I could wipe away the final traces of psychological doubt that remained from being branded an undesirable American. This before Coyote and I became involved. I felt a deep gratitude to them. Indeed, baseball itself was my textbook for years. Every night for at least those first 4 years in Japan, I had religiously watched the one-hour evening baseball news program at 11 o'clock, furiously copying down new vocabulary, question forms, grammatical patterns, idiomatic expressions in my notebook. I memorized all the professional Japanese players' names and their kanji characters. Always the next day I tried to use the new vocabulary in baseball conversations with my buddies and their friends. It seemed most Japanese men loved baseball, so it was easy to engage in baseball conversation anyone I met, and in so doing activate the new knowledge I'd gained and get a lot of listening practice and repetition in the process. It didn't take long to extend my conversational ability beyond the topic of baseball. By using different verbs and nouns and fitting them into the many sentence and grammatical patterns I was learning through my baseball studies, I could make the switch easily enough. Eventually, I was able to converse on a number of topics, and the liquor store became my main classroom for the language. It was the hangout joint for all the players, and I spent countless hours there practicing Japanese conversation. Another wave of nostalgia for the days when my legs were still fully functional passed through me. Sports were a big part of my life then, and I'd been a pretty good athlete. Coyote, too, had been an excellent volleyball player in high school, captaining her team to the semifinals of her prefecture's championships. In the early days of our relationship, we often talked about our athletic exploits. She saw me play in a couple of softball games and a basketball game in Osaka, too, as I played for 3 years in a city league in a suburb of Osaka during the winters. What she saw of my athleticism was only the waning portion of what it had once been, but there were a few moments in those games when flashes of the earlier grace and fluidity came through. So it was for me watching her during the year in Fukuoka she played Mama-san volleyball with women in their 30s. Her reactions had diminished, but her court sense, concentration, and leadership were apparent. Yeah, sports were but one of the many things we shared, one of the many things we had in common, and like all things in life, it had been a temporary greatness now reduced to mere memory. The plane ride to Basel took 1 hour and 20 minutes. A light rain was falling when we arrived. The customs and passport control passed us through with just a cursory glance. There were 2 exits at the airport, one to France and the other to Switzerland. We went through the Switzerland exit, and Cowardy got his tickets for a bus that took us to the Basel downtown train station. From there, we took a taxi to the Alexander Hotel. We arrived just before 6 o'clock, checked in, and just as we started to get in the elevator, there was a call from Undine.
"Undine, I'm just so very, very sorry for you and your family," I said.
"Yes, thank you very much. You came just 3 days late, but I still want to see you," Undine said.
"We'll be here tomorrow and the next day and leave on Thursday. We can come to your shop if that's the easiest way."
"That's a good idea. The shop is very close to the Lorach station."
"Okay, that's good. I expect you'll be very busy tomorrow. How about if we visit on Wednesday?"
"Yeah, that's better for me."
"Okay, can I call you at your home tomorrow to set a time and see if everything is okay?"
"You have my telephone number?"
"Yeah, Marion gave it to me."
"Okay, then please call me tomorrow. In the night is best, I think. Thank you very much, David."
"Thank you. We're looking forward to seeing you, Undine. You take care." We were now officially checked into Basel, home of the Sandoz Company's Pharmaceutical Chemical Research Laboratory, where the fascinating, complex, and dramatic history of LSD had its birth. This was where Albert Hofmann, a Swiss chemist working at Sandoz, first synthesized LSD in 1938 and 5 years later accidentally intoxicated himself and had the world's first acid trip. A couple days later, he intentionally took the drug and soon after provided samples to Walter Stoll, son of Hofmann's superior and a psychiatrist at the psychiatric clinic in Zurich. Stoll conducted the first scientific study of LSD in volunteers and psychiatric patients, and his observations were published in Swiss Archives of Neurology in 1947. His report became a sensation in the scientific world and stimulated a flurry of laboratory and clinical research in many countries. Hundreds of papers were published over the next decade, setting the stage for the consciousness expansion rage of the psychedelic 60s. By 1970, somewhere between 1 and 5 million people had turned on. Names and places ran through my head. Aldous Huxley on his deathbed asking his wife to administer 100 mmg of acid. Alan Dulles, Dr. Sidney Gottlieb, and the CIA during the MK Ultra days when CIA spooks secretly observed prisoners and prostitutes' clients wiped out unwittingly on acid and reported their findings to their bosses, who were trying to gain a mind control advantage over the Russians. Timothy Leary, Michael Hollinshead, Allen Ginsberg, and others tripping out at Leary's LSD commune in Millbrook, New York. Ken Kesey and his merry pranksters flying across the U.S. in their magic bus further. Al, Captain Trips Hubbard, the Johnny Appleseed of LSD, spanning the globe and introducing LSD and psilocybin to thousands of people, including scientists, politicians, intelligence officers, diplomats, and church figures in a grand attempt to turn on the world. Hofmann, the LSD father, and Leary, the apostle, meeting once in Lausanne and once more here in Basel, when Leary came to Switzerland to petition for political asylum after escaping from prison, and Pittsburgh Pirate pitcher Doc Ellis tossing a no-hit, no-run game on acid. He walked 8 batters and hit 2 more. Laser beams of multicolored light flashing into the catcher's mitt and remaining visible to him after each pitch left his fingertips. Cowardy was more interested in the artistic than the psychedelic history of Basel. She wanted to see as many museums as she could. After we returned from a stroll and supper at a restaurant on the Klarplatz, she began making preparations for the next day's sightseeing. The following morning at 10:30, we joined 4 other tourists for an hour-and-a-half bus tour of the city. At noon, I rested on a train station bench while Cowardy bought advance tickets to Florence. Among the paintings of the Alps on the walls, there was one of the Matterhorn. I thought back to my 1973 journey when I camped out near Zermatt, began walking the climbing road the next morning, stopped across from an old stone farmhouse, and a plump, rosy woman invited me into the house for coffee and breakfast. I returned to the hotel for a nap while Cowardy explored the city further on bicycle. It was raining lightly outside when I woke up, so I spent much of the afternoon reading the Herald Tribune. The front page story was about a huge earthquake near Izmit, Turkey. Thousands of people were feared dead. Hassan and I had passed through that area on our journey after leaving Thomas's place. My gut tightened as I read the story. Another omen. All the coincidences began to weigh on me again. The weather finally cleared. I decided to do some exploring myself. If I sat in the hotel room thinking about Thomas and now the thousands of dead in Turkey, I'd work myself into a morbid depression. I walked to the Rhine, crossed the Mittler Bridge, and came to the Marktplatz. There were many shoppers out. A small crowd had gathered at one spot to listen to a street performer playing a concertina. I stopped to watch the man. He was a German, about 40, with a receding hairline, a large pair of glasses perched on the tip of his nose, and dressed in raggedy clothes. Set out in front of him was his battered concertina case and a handwritten sign advertising private lessons. He reminded me of Peter, the German drifter I'd met in Sicily the first time I'd left the States. The concertina player threw his head about vigorously and grimaced while playing a succession of wonderful pieces. Sweat ran down his forehead. Some of the bystanders tossed coins into his case. I returned across the bridge and walked back up the Griffengasse. Roadwork was being done on the tram tracks. The street was partially dug up and blocked off to traffic, but some people were walking dogs and pushing baby carts on the sidewalks. Workmen in yellow shirts and bright orange pants shoveled and smoothed out the concrete, pouring through long hydraulic hoses attached to two huge concrete mixers. Farther up the street beyond the roadwork, a group of Hare Krishnas chanted and banged their tambourines. I stopped at an outdoor cafe to rest my legs and drink a beer before heading back to the hotel. I couldn't get the German concertina player's image out of my head.